From the Watson Institute at Brown University, this is Trending Globally. I'm Sarah Baldwin. The lives of women in the Middle East and South Asia are too often viewed by us in the West as sort of one-dimensional. They're seen as subjugated and in need of help in their own liberation. Of course, this view obscures the complex, nuanced efforts to gain gender equality in those countries. Women-led movements during and after the Arab uprisings of the last decade have shown
the politics around gender are central to understanding what is happening in the country at large.
That's Nadia Al-Ali, professor of international studies at Watson, and one of my three guests on this episode. She, along with Catherine Poots and Denise Candiotti, recently edited the anthology Gender, Governance, and Islam, which explores the complex ways gender, politics, and religion interact in Muslim-majority countries. The Center for Middle East Studies brought all three to Watson this fall, and we were thrilled to have them on the show. Catherine, Nadia, Denise, welcome, and thank you for coming in to talk about your work today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
I want to start with a very basic question. I know a lot of this seems very obvious to you because you've devoted your lives and your careers to this sort of thinking. But just for our listeners who are not necessarily in the academy, I want to just ask, what does it mean to de-orientalize scholarship on gender in Muslim countries, and why is it important?
Well, for a long time, or until today, actually, when we look at media and policy circles, women in relation to the Middle East very much represented as oppressed, poor oppressed women. The veil is often used as a symbol of this oppression. They're without agency. And this kind of discourse that's very prevalent until today in the media and in policy circles is then also used to kind of signal the difference between the civilized West and the barbaric other, the Middle East. There's a long history of this being used to justify colonial interventions and sort of military invasions. I mean, it was most obvious in the context of Afghanistan to some extent, in relation to Iraq. And this kind of representation totally glosses over the fact that women in the Middle East come in all sorts. And yes, there are structural inequalities. Yes, they're facing all kinds of forms of discrimination, but so are women elsewhere in the world. But they do have agency, they do mobilize, and what we need is nuance.
Right, because it is a very, very diverse region, diverse in terms of people, in terms of cultures, and in terms of expressions of Islam, right? I mean, you have these nine case studies. Did anything emerge as similarities or commonalities among the nine case studies that you did, or were they all just unique and diverse in their own way?
Well, I think they're all unique and diverse in their own ways, but you do have transnational dimensions that each country has to interpolate and deal with, and also to deal with essentializations of the region, of the religion, of the culture, and also deal with the geopolitics, which have changed enormously since Women Islam in the State, and the fractures that have come from those convulsions, and how people on the ground have to deal with the rise of these new divisions. And so there are commonalities in that sense of having to deal with the intervention coming from external places, but how that's handled locally is very particular, depending on the certain circumstances in each country.
And to add to that, so another common theme, or a couple of common themes that I'd see in the book, is that the different case studies show that politics of gender are central to understanding all the big issues, whether it is understanding political authoritarianism, whether it is understanding social transformations linked to attempts at democratization, whether it is linked to sectarianism and so on. We see that in the different contexts, the politics around gender are central to understanding what is happening in the country at large.
That's a great point, Nadia. Can you give an example, say Egypt, or any example that you choose, of how that plays out, how that is expressed in politics and policy?
Yeah, sure. So I give you an example of the chapter that I wrote in Iraq. So since the invasion of Iraq in 2003, you had an increasing rise of sectarian politics. And that increase in sectarian politics very much revolved around laws that controlled women's bodies. So, for instance, the Personal Status Code, which is a set of laws that governs divorce, marriage, child custody, and inheritance, has been used as a way to demarcate boundaries between the different religious groups. When a Islamist militia, whether they were Sunni or Shia, when they moved into a neighborhood in Iraq, the first thing they did was to ask women to dress in a certain way. They tried to control their mobility. They tried to control, whether they would go to work or not. And it is clear that then the contestations around this different political and economic constituencies very much used women's bodies and later on also, I would say, men's bodies who did not align with heteronormative ideals. So, you know, there was also, for instance, a targeting of gay men.
Well, I think it's broader than that because the commonalities reside from the fact that wherever they are, these countries are engaging with what I call a global gender equality regime. And this is obviously the successive conventions that have been passed through the decades for women by the United Nations. What is, of course, very interesting is that this system leaves different footprints in different places. So in countries like Palestine or in regions like Palestine, or say Afghanistan, where aid is much more directly externally mediated, that footprint is obviously much larger. In countries like Egypt and Turkey, it is still there. But what strikes me in all the cases is how these platforms are used entirely instrumentally by various states.
Say a little bit what you
mean. Well, what I mean by this is take the example of Turkey. When Turkey was in the process of European accession, we're talking about the period from 1999 to, say, 2004, when very progressive legislation was passed, the Turkish government was happy to let women's rights NGOs represent Turkey in public fora and basically show the world and Europe that it was implementing progressive policies in that domain. However, at a later stage, while it was simultaneously, you know, underwriting these various conventions, and later the Istanbul Convention, which is on violence against women, in 2012, that the Turkey government ratified among the first, they were clawing back all these rights in an internal politic of placating constituencies with more Islamist leanings. So governments have been playing that to the extent that some writers have said that women's rights had become the fig leaf of authoritarian governments who had no intention of democratizing, but were giving way slightly on women's rights. Even Saudi Arabia was playing that game, mm-hmm. you know, with the king presenting himself as a modernizer and giving minute participation in politics to women on municipal councils and so on. It was really minute. Nonetheless, you know, that was a way of signaling an intent to modernize, and so on. However, even though this was very instrumental, within all these countries, you had groups of women trying to use this wedge to get in there and try to move the system along, you see? So it was a very complicated politics of internal actors using international fora, like European Union-funded NGOs, and trying to nudge the government and governments appearing to give way whilst at the same time sabotaging the women's NGOs. So I think Turkey is a particularly useful case study, but all the case studies in the books show that to some extent, even in Palestine, showing how in the tussle between Hamas and Fatah, the women's rights platforms are appropriated in instrumental ways by both actors.
But they themselves as well are playing active roles in sort of trying to make it work for them as well, the women.
women's group.
Exactly. But you see, the women are often in a very difficult situation because, you know, they are trying. Well, first of all, they're not united. They're also politically divided. But what you see is they're trying to make the most of the spaces created by these interstices with some very strange alliances. Like in Egypt, for example, after the Arab uprising, we see, so you have all these changing combinations which are conjunctural and have to be very minutely analyzed.
Is what you just mentioned an example, maybe a modern iteration of what you called the patriarchal bargain or not? Is this something else entirely?
It is, I think, well, first of all, I have slightly moved beyond the term patriarchy in my own thinking because I feel that there have been such incredible changes in the societies we're talking about that I prefer now to use the term politics of masculinist restoration, by which I mean a situation where power holders are trying to hold on to male privileges.
Or recapture even.
Recapture even. And in order to do that, they have to expend a lot of institutional and ideological energy because, you know, male hegemony is not a given anymore in societies where women are more mobile, more visible, more demanding of their rights, and so on. And in Turkey, I think that the exponential increase in violence against women cannot really simply be taken as an expression of patriarchy as we knew it. And this masculinist restoration is both top-down, with states, despite the laws, upholding judgments in court which are unfavorable to women, and from the street up, with men doing things with impunity, knowing that the judiciary will treat them leniently. And we've had many cases like that.
Which, of course, is not only happening in the Middle East and South Asian regions. I mean, it's happening in the United States of America, in Hungary, you know, in locations around the world of this masculinist restoration. And Trump is a prime example of that, and in his politics and the rise of the far right, and which is not just a simple divide between men and women. I think there's men on both sides and women on both sides of this supposed divide. So I think that's important to point out. And my chapter, which focused on the so-called Muslim diaspora, did not exist in Women, Islam, and the State. And I think it's a result of more transnational exchanges, more the geopolitical situation, which has changed as well, and the more voices coming from the so-called, you know, Muslim diaspora, as well as online activity. And so this is a chapter that didn't exist in the first book. And the first section looks at the making of the so-called Muslim diaspora, of looking at how did this essentialized, fixed ideas of what Muslims are emerge, especially when earlier, you know, in the 1980s, in most Muslim contexts, people referred to people from the
North
parts of the world as North African,
not
or
Muslim.
Yes, or
right.
Pakistani, or, you know, Iraqi,
and so that has changed, especially in Europe.
Yes, absolutely, and now in the United States, as well, and in Canada. And so my chapter tried to trace, you know, how did that happen? And so I crunched lots of material and came up with three different areas, which is looking at, you know, Muslims trying to carve out a space in Western secular societies, which all have their own situations depending on each country's history and how they locate religion within their power structures. And I look at that very closely because what's fascinating across the board are the need for Muslim representation, which is really hard when you have such great heterogeneity,
right,
among Muslim populations living in the West.
And you point out that it's often older male conservatives who sort of step forward to say, I'll represent us.
In most cases.
And who's us?
And that's been the case, which has really muted a lot of great work that is already happening on the grassroots level among women's organizations who are really trying to tackle problems that they're facing living outside their countries of descent and the problems that come with generational change. So a lot of women's groups have been extremely active. You know, this mixed with neo liberal policies as well, and the recoiling of the welfare states, which took a lot of money away from the pockets of women's organizations, combined with, you know, community brokers that tend to be conservative men who then did not channel money as well to local women's groups. So there's a combination of reasons why I think a lot of the issues that pertain to women in the family and gender politics were largely ignored and masked, even though there was a lot of things happening.
It's my impression that most people researching and writing about gender are women. Is that right?
Well, yes, but it's changing. So certainly when I started to work, well, it was sort of women and gender studies, and it was mainly women studying women. Then I think about 10 years ago, we started to have some male colleagues mainly studying men and masculinities. And now you have a greater number of male colleagues also doing queer studies. So that's sort of all under the broader umbrella. But one of the things that definitely changed, and I mentioned it when we had the book launch in London, is that when I started out, I would go to these big conferences like the Middle East Studies Association of Northern America, and I would be on a panel where all female, either postgraduate students or faculty, and would talk about women and gender in the context of, you know, different countries and different political, economic, social processes. And then there would be these panels on Iraq and social transformation, or Egypt and civil society. They were all men talking about the big issues. And we women would go to these panels and listen carefully and then intervene by saying, so where is the gender lens? They would never come to our panels. And that has definitely changed. So the panels, A, are much more mixed. But also I feel that in terms of the audience, our male colleagues are taking us more seriously and are recognizing that the study of gender, whether it is sort of more traditional work focusing on women and women's movements, or work on power relations more broadly, intersectional approaches, or men masculinities or queer studies, that those lenses and analysis are actually essential to understanding the big issues. And I think that is a slow changing process. It is maybe more developed in some disciplines than others. So I guess in politics, international relations, it's not so much developed, more so in disciplines like anthropology.
There's also something else, of course, that this is an area which blossomed attached to a social movement. You can't separate that from the growth of feminist movements. Now, what happened, however, certainly in the United States since the 70s and the 80s, is that you started getting men's movements. And that changed the dynamics. It's not just that the field of men and masculinities came about, but there was actually quite a divide. Initially, you know, the men in men's groups and so on were quite critical of the male role as, you know, conventionally conceived. And you had groups of men who were sympathetic to feminism and quite critical of the male role as conventionally conceived. However, I mean, we're now looking at a deep, deep crisis in gender relations. The gender order has pretty much collapsed. Now, what is interesting is that it's happening everywhere. This is not like a Western, you know, it's really happening anywhere. Everything is up for negotiation, up for grabs. But this is not a civic, pleasant discussion. It's happening on the streets of Mexico, where you have femicides. It's happening in Soweto, where gang rape of women has become a kind of pastime of unemployed males. And it's happening in the United States. So I'm not sure yet what we're looking at, but I think that we're looking at something very frightening and deeply significant in terms of politics with a big P and recruitment to various kinds of politics with a big P. So it's not just gender politics. Gender politics has become politics writ large.
Well, because everything's at stake.
Yes.
Everything is at stake.
Everything is at stake.
Like human history,
absolutely.
The way it's been, it's the true. Way it has played out is at stake.
It's
for,
huge.
For
the
these
stakes
guys.
Are absolutely huge, yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about your methodology? Was there anything that surprised you?
Well, in terms of my chapter, which focused on the so-called Muslim diaspora, what I did is I looked first at mainly secondary research that looked at how did this idea of a singular fixed notion of Muslims as a cultural political bloc, how did that emerge? And then I sort of dived inside the diaspora, which shows the how diverse it is and how there's so much movement and there's so many things that are really happening. And what I find that is often ignored is looking at how these constructions of the Muslim other, how does that impact on subgroupings within Muslim communities? And how they start to play against each other or with each other. So I think that was really important for my chapter, is to really try to shed light on some of the internal dynamics within, not only to show how heterogeneous it is, but also look at how geopolitical situations, how politics back home, how the rise of the male authority leaders, both at, you know, places of dissent, as well as in the United States or in Britain or in France.
In adopted countries.
How does that play out in the boundaries within and between Muslim groupings in diasporic communities? And my approach has always been largely ethnographic. So, you know, my work, I would spend a lot of time in people's homes, in kitchens, around tables, in makeshift community centers, in, you know, wherever, at ceremonies, at weddings, at different spaces that you can see how people are trying to deal with the layers of problems that they have to navigate. And how it's not only happening within communities, but within families, you know, and how, you know, what it means to be a Muslim woman and what it means to be a Muslim man, and how that is contested, performed, played out, negotiated.
And how that has infinite expressions as
yes,
well.
Yes, and how that can then feed into the movements that are more visible and that stretch across different boundaries as well. So that's the argument I try to make in the chapter.
This is what makes it so actually interesting, I think, in this volume. And one thing that surprised me, I must say, is that the one constant that runs through is resistance. There isn't a single country where we didn't find instances of individual or collective resistance. So the Saudi chapter is about runaway girls, those who flee the male guardianship system. In the Pakistan case study, we have these bloggers on sexual liberties platforms, which to me was very surprising. I'd never really thought of Pakistan in terms of, you know, having constituencies that uphold sexual liberties. But there you go. Although, of course, there's been a whole debate about hijras and, you know, is there a third sex? Legislation was indeed passed. But across all the case study, there isn't a single case study where you don't find clear-cut cases of resistance against gender orders.
Is it okay if I say that I think that's a good thing?
Oh, yeah. Well, also,
can
it
we
reflects,
be normative?
No, but it also reflects reality. I mean, this is what is actually happening. And we've been seeing that ever since the Arab uprisings. It's been beamed internationally.
And it's been incredibly creative and artistic and playful and trying to find unassuming, disarming ways to find the cracks, to express one's, to be subversive. And I think this is really interesting to see sort of the political aesthetics of the different uprisings and how they are all very particular and have particular cases and are fighting for certain problems of inequality of different kinds, but they also build off each other. There's reverberations and they learn from each other and they're connected as well.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, since we wrote and published the book, of course, many things have happened. We've seen the significance of women in the context of the Sudan, which, I mean, although it's still early days, but it seems to be one of the more successful and hopeful contexts. As I said, you know, we'll see how it's unfolding. Then again, we had also another wave of protests in Egypt that was violently hacked down by the government, with about 2,000 people being arrested following this. And of course, now as we speak, we see in Lebanon protests where especially women have been at the forefront of trying to be physical buffers between the police and the state forces and protesters. I mean, I have lots of friends in Lebanon. Actually, one friend who went from Providence to Beirut because she wanted to be part of the uprisings. And so I hear, you know, every day precisely what Catherine was saying, you know, very creative ways of protesting. Now, in the Iraqi context, that to my mind is particularly moving because Catherine just showed me just now today, four more people were killed. So this is not a non-violent, peaceful situation. This is a situation where several hundred people have been killed by security forces, militia. Nevertheless, women of all generations have been out on the street. And that is very surprising to me because Iraq, unlike Lebanon, is a country where it has been much more difficult for women to be in public spaces. I mean, since 2003, there has been a kind of shift towards much more conservative gender norms and relations. And the images that I've seen over the last 2 years, although heartbreaking in terms of the violence, is also incredibly inspiring in terms of, you know, women out there. And as I said, you know, not all kinds of generations, and some with veils, some without, and with jeans. And there's one iconic image, a young man and a young woman with masks to support them in terms of tear gas, kissing in a public space. And this is totally unheard of in the Iraqi context.
Catherine, Nadia, Denise, thank you all so much for coming in and talking to us today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
This episode of Trending Globally was produced by Dan Richards. Our theme music is by Henry Bloomfield. I'm Sarah Baldwin. You can subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. If you like what you hear, leave us a rating and review on iTunes. It really helps others find the show. For more information about this and other shows, go to watson.brown.edu. Thanks for listening, and tune in 2 weeks for another episode of Trending Globally.